Dr. Call mentioned the striking results being observed with the CD30 chemo-fused agent SGN-35 or brentuximab vedotin, and I met with Dr. David Strauss to talk about this and other advances in the management of Hodgkin disease and other hematologic cancers. And Dr. Strauss began our conversation by discussing B-vedotin.
We are now seeing a number of new drugs that look very promising, and Hodgkin lymphoma, the problem has not been drug resistance because there are many chemotherapy drugs that are active. And Vinblastine is probably the most active and has been widely used for decades. But we now have some new agents that are really novel and I think are very promising. In particular, the report of SGN-35 that was presented at the meeting was really very, very impressive.
Can you talk a little bit about what that agent is?
So this is an immunotoxin, which is a fusion molecule of a monoclonal antibody directed against CD30, which is expressed on the Reed-Sternberg cells of classical Hodgkin lymphoma. And it is attached to a toxin, auristatin, which is a mitotic spindle inhibitor. So the results of this study were really, really impressive. The overall response rate was 75% with 34% complete responses. And this was in a very heavily prior treated group of patients, all of whom had prior autologous stem cell transplants. And I think 70% of them were primary refractory. That is, they didn't respond really to their frontline treatment. So this is quite a spectacular result. Now, it's kind of interest that this is a spindle inhibitor because actually Vinblastine, which is probably the best single conventional agent, is also works by this mechanism. So this may be kind of a targeted form of a drug, sort of like Vinblastine with a similar mechanism, which may explain why the results are so impressive. What's really of interest is the toxin that they're using. I mean, I think that this was a very smart choice, particularly for Hodgkin lymphoma.
Now, what was seen in terms of side effects and toxicity?
Well, the side effects were kind of similar to vinc alkaloids, actually, particularly neuropathy. Sensory neuropathy was seen in 43% of patients. Grade 3 was seen in only 5% of patients, but fatigue, nausea, most of these were grade 1 and 2 toxicities. But I think the neurotoxicity is interesting because it's what's seen also with the vinc alkaloids.
It's interesting, too, because this agent I was telling you about in breast cancer has very, very little systemic toxicity. So I don't know whether the sort of the engineering is a little bit different. Have you had any patients receive this agent?
We have participated in the trials. I don't actually have any personally in this registration trial, which was reported. There are a couple of follow-up studies. There is a study of SGN-35, I believe, with ABVD, which is being conducted by Dr. Yunus at MD Anderson. And we are participating in a trial of maintenance treatment or not, actually a randomized placebo-controlled trial of SGN-35 versus placebo for patients with relapsed refractory Hodgkin lymphoma who've received autologous stem cell transplantation. I actually have a patient on this study. I don't know what he's on because it's randomized placebo-controlled, so we'll see.
And how often is the agent given?
The schedule is every 3 weeks as a intravenous infusion, 30-minute infusion. The dose that they used in this trial, which is a registration study, was 1.8 milligrams per kilogram.
What about duration of response and clinical utility? You probably have talked to people who have had patients receive this. Beyond the waterfall plot, so to speak, what's going on in terms of clinical benefit?
Well, the progression-free survival that they reported was 26 weeks, and they actually continued treating. So they went up to 16 cycles of treatment. So I don't know if these are unmaintained remissions or if this is pretty much they were continued on treatment.
Any other discussions about strategies about how to incorporate this agent into treatment? You mentioned a couple. Any other trials out there or ideas out there that are being pursued? I'm sure there are plenty.
Well, these are the two studies that I'm aware of. And the problem with untreated patients is, you know, it's just you have a very high bar. So you really need a large number of patients to really see what you're doing. I mean, I think that the trial that's in progress is probably a phase one, phase two study and not really a phase three study, but that will be an ambitious study because it'll require a lot of patients to really see a difference.
Now, we're going to talk about T-cell lymphoma, but maybe you can just talk a little bit about the spectrum of CD30 positive cancers that are out there that might be potential targets.
What I think is really quite interesting is that there was a companion study, which was also reported at ASH, of SGN35 in a subgroup of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, which is called anaplastic large T-cell lymphoma. And in this lymphoma, the tumor cells also express CD30 in common with the Reed-Sternberg cells of Hodgkin lymphoma, though the Reed-Sternberg cells are not T-cells. And so it's a target also, and a very impressive result was reported. I think it was in the neighborhood of 80% overall response rate. And again, the peripheral T-cell lymphomas are 5 to 10% of non-Hodgkin lymphomas. So although Hodgkin lymphoma is not a common disease, this is an even less common disease. But again, an excellent response.
What about other tumors, immunologic tumors, solid tumors? I mean, do you see CD30 positivity in any other types of cancers, even in a small minority?
I don't really know about solid tumors. It's a TNF superreceptor family, and it was discovered actually in cell lines from Hodgkin lymphoma. And then they did find that it is also expressed in this subgroup of peripheral T-cell lymphoma, is also expressed in some B-cell non-Hodgkin lymphomas. In particular, the primary mediastinal diffuse large B-cell lymphomas, which are CD20 positive B-cell lymphomas, often express CD30. And I think there is some data to suggest that there's a relationship between this particular non-Hodgkin lymphoma and Hodgkin lymphoma. But I'm not really aware of its expression really in other types of cancers.
I want to talk a little bit about T-cell lymphoma, but just to finish out on Hodgkin, what else is going on in terms of new agents, new strategies out there that may be coming to the clinic in the near future?
Well, there were a couple of other new agents showing promise that were reported at ASH. One of these was panobinostat, a HDAC inhibitor, histone deacetylase inhibitor, which was reported in a similar population, a large study, which also got an oral presentation, to have around a 30% response rate. And there are several other related drugs, HDAC inhibitors, that have also around a 30% response rate. Mosatinostat was one that was reported in a smaller study in a poster. And 30% has been kind of what's been seen for single agents with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. I would think that vinblastin probably gets around a 30 to 40% overall response rate. That would be complete plus partial responses. So that's why I think the SGN35 result of 72% is really quite impressive.
Let's talk a little bit about T-cell lymphoma, and I'm going to ask you to take a crack at something I asked a number of people, which is to try to, in a, as simple as possible way, talk a little bit about the classification.
Well, I think there are two categories. There's cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, mycosis fungoides being the most common, which is really a really separate issue. It's a really different disease than the other non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And then there are the peripheral T-cell lymphomas, which is a real mishmash. I think they have in common a bad prognosis as compared to their B-cell counterparts, with the exception of some cases of the anaplastic large T-cell lymphoma, particularly those that are associated with the 2,5 translocation resulting in overexpression of the MPM-ALK protein. So these cases can be diagnosed by immunohistochemistry against the ALK protein. So the anaplastic large T-cell lymphomas that are ALK positive seem to have a better prognosis than the rest of the peripheral T-cell lymphoma. So they are a mishmash of different diseases. In common, they have a rather poor prognosis to conventional approaches. The patients who are ALK positive, we usually treat with conventional chemotherapy. I mean, the results with CHOP, for example, cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, vincristine, prednisone, are pretty respectable. And that's in contrast to the rest of the peripheral T-cell lymphomas. So there is no consensus about the treatment of the peripheral T-cell lymphomas. But a number of centers, including our own and some international studies in Europe, have been looking at the use of peripheral blood stem cell transplantation up front as part of the first treatment. The new agent that's been approved for the first time for the treatment of peripheral T-cell lymphoma is pralatrexate, actually a drug that was invented at Memorial Hospital and developed by Frank Sorotnik at Sloan Kettering Institute. And this is an anti-fol that has a better affinity for the folate acid, reduced folate receptor on tumor cells, gets into the tumor cells better in preclinical studies. It is polyglutamated better than drugs like methotrexate, and it is pumped out less avidly. And so this drug, the PROPEL study, reported around, 27 to 30% overall response rate in relapse refractory peripheral T-cell lymphoma, which was enough to get approval. So this is the first drug to be approved for peripheral T-cell lymphoma. Now, another HDAC inhibitor, romidepsin, also was reported at the ASH meeting and I think already has an indication for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, but I believe will be approved for peripheral T-cell lymphoma, again, around a 30% response rate.
Can you talk a little bit about the clinical utilization of these two agents, how they're given, what your experience has been, what kind of side effects and toxicity?
Well, I can tell you about a patient that I have. I know you like that.
Yep.
I have a very interesting response to pralatrexate. So this is a man in his 60s who had a huge infiltrating tumor in his left neck, which was really probably arising in a lymph node, but infiltrating soft tissue, skin, was ulcerated. And the histology was ALK-negative anaplastic large T-cell lymphoma. And he had a lot of systemic symptoms, particularly fevers, night sweats, and terrible diarrhea. And so he really had a very poor response to CHOP.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? This is the only site of his disease?
Yes, but it was massive. I mean, we're talking about a 15, 20 centimeter mass invading the whole skin.
Wow. And what was the presumed mechanism of the diarrhea?
I think it's some sort of paraneoplastic syndrome.
Wow.
I mean, we know that Hodgkin lymphoma produces a lot of chemokines, cytokines that can reduce systemic symptoms. Some of the T-cell lymphomas do as well. So I think, I don't know what cytokine, but I think it's some sort of paraneoplastic, probably cytokine-mediated thing.
Just out of curiosity, when you used anti-diarrheal strategies on this man,
didn't work. He was hospitalized multiple times with this.
Wow. So what happened?
So I'm treating him with pralatrexate, and he has had a complete response.
Wow.
I mean, all his symptoms have disappeared, and basically the tumor is really gone. The problem is the toxicity, and pralatrexate is an anti-fol, and it has a rather sort of small window of a therapeutic index. And it was shown in the phase one studies that the mucositis, which is the really big problem with the drug, can be somewhat attenuated by using supplementation with vitamin B12 and folic acid, but it doesn't completely take away the side effects. So my challenge with this guy has been to kind of maintain him without giving him grade 3 or 4 mucositis. He's actually had to be hospitalized a couple of times with the mucositis.
What happened to his diarrhea?
The diarrhea and the systemic symptoms, the fevers and sweats and so on, completely went away early on.
Interesting.
So I think pralatrexate is a very powerful drug. I mean, again, anecdotes are anecdotes, but this was quite a dramatic response.
What's the thinking in moving forward in terms of where pralatrexate is going to fit in terms of other research strategies?
There are studies that are moving it into the front line. I think with CHOP is one strategy. So I think that it will be incorporated as part of the frontline strategy.
Now, how about romidepsin in terms of, again, the clinical utilization of this agent and what is seen in terms of the tolerability?
Again, it is an HDAC inhibitor. It is approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which, again, is a really separate group of diseases. It is intravenous as compared to some of the other HDAC inhibitors, which are oral. But again, it'll be a second drug that will be available for this indication. These drugs cause fatigue. They can cause diarrhea. There were, in some of the early studies, there were some cardiac arrhythmias, although I guess in more recent studies with dosing, this has not been really a problem. But I'm glad that there will be at least 2 kids on the block and maybe more in the future that will be approved for use.
How do you currently, outside a protocol setting, utilize these 2 agents in terms of sequence, both in cutaneous T-cell when it needs to be treated systemically as well as peripheral?
Well, the HDAC inhibitors, romidepsin and vorinostat, are approved for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that needs systemic treatment. And these are among a huge list of agents that are active in advanced stages of cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, including most chemotherapy agents. Every class of chemotherapy agent almost has a 20% to 40% response rate, as does romidepsin and vorinostat. Bexarotene is another agent, a RXR antagonist retinoid, which actually was one of the first systemic agents to get approval for cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. Again, around a 30% to 40% response rate. I was actually involved with this drug from the get-go, and the first signal that we had of some activity came from phase 1 trial that we did at Memorial, and this led to a large licensing trial, both in early stage refractory and advanced stages, and led to its approval. So there are a whole bunch of different agents, interferon as a biological agent, all have activity in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that needs systemic treatment. The problem is that unlike the other non-Hodgkin lymphomas and Hodgkin lymphoma, where you can treat for a period of time and expect to have durable, unmaintained remissions, the remissions in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma really last as long as you're treating the patient. So when you stop treatment, it comes back pretty soon.
Any feeling, or I guess a sort of indirect comparison in terms of the efficacy that's seen with pralatrexate versus romidepsin versus denileukin diftatox, all these agents, it sounds like you're saying they kind of all have similar efficacies. Do you then decide based on the side effects what to use?
Yes, I think they all have pretty similar activities. Pralatrexate, there is a trial that we've been conducting in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, which I think they'll be applying for a label for that. But again, there's a lot of different things you can try. And I think bexarotene, I think, has been quite popular because it's an oral agent. And vorinostat is also an oral agent, the HDAC inhibitor. But there are lots of chemotherapy drugs. There are lots of things you can do. And denileukin diftatox also, which is one of the first immunotoxins that came on the market maybe close to 10 years ago, is another agent that has activity.
Yeah, that was the next thing I was going to ask you about, because denileukin kind of has a bad name, so to speak, I guess, in terms of some of the problems that were seen when it was first developed. Can you talk about that and currently, you know, how it's utilized?
Well, I think that part of the problem was that the registration trials did not permit the use of steroids. So a lot of infusion type effects, including edema and so on, were seen. But I think now it's pretty standard to use corticosteroids with use of this. And I think that the infusion reactions that were reported in the registration trials are really not as severe as really what's seen with current pre-medication drugs.
Let's just finish out talking a little bit about cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. You've been mentioning that it's conceptually different.
Right.
Can you just kind of paint a picture of the disease and how it's managed?
Well, it's a disease that is in the skin but not of the skin. And it really behaves like a dermatologic disease in a vast number of patients. It's a very rare cancer. It's estimated that there may be 1 to 2 to maybe up to 3,000 new cases per year in the entire U.S. It tends to be a chronic disease, particularly in the earlier stages, so that the prevalence may be 15 or 20,000 patients. So it is quite a rare disease, and that's why there are sort of a handful of medical oncologists and dermatologists who have an experience and interest in this in the country. The early stages, patch plaque disease in particular, is a common presentation. This can be clinically more like psoriasis than a cancer, even though it is technically a cancer. And the approach has been topical treatment or radiation treatment, and then systemic treatment for more refractory cases. The early stages are not associated with a decreased survival, particularly. Now, the advanced stages are really much more of a problem, and the problem is not so much organ failure due to cancer, but due to skin tumors that are ulcerated and chronically infected, so that patients will usually succumb to infections. Because it's like the ulcerated, open, weeping tumors are just a culture media. So you treat one organism and they get infected with another.
You said that this is a disease in the skin but not of the skin. Can you trace out the biology, what we know about it a little bit more?
It's not really known why these cells go to the skin. I mean, it is a lymphoma, but it really stays pretty much in the skin. So it is not very usual to see involvement of other sites without extensive skin involvement. So involvement of lymph nodes and involvement of other organs are unusual without extensive skin involvement. So its early stages pretty much is a dermatologic disease. It's a skin disease. Even though it's not of skin cells, it's of lymphoma cells that, for reasons that we don't really understand, go to the skin.
And what's the point at which these patients should be under a medical oncologist, or at least care, or at least see a medical oncologist?
Well, I think the patients who are candidates for systemic treatment are really the ones who a medical oncologist will see. And these would be refractory patients with plaque patch disease, extensive disease, who require treatment. I think the patients with erythroderma, Sézary syndrome is a form of this in which, in addition to the overall involvement of the skin, the cells are also present in the peripheral blood. And this is associated with terrible pruritus in many patients. These are also patients for systemic treatment. And then patients with tumor stage disease, which would be stage 2B, stage 3 would be erythroderma, and stage 4 would be disease in skin and non-skin sites, 4A being lymph nodes and extensive blood involvement, stage 4B would be skin and other organs, such as the bone marrow or liver or spleen. Now, most dermatologists are not really very comfortable with systemic treatment. So I would say that once you get beyond topical treatments, light treatments, that most dermatologists will refer patients to a medical oncologist.